With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to the Top Order Podcast. It's Monday night here in New Zealand. We've all had a hard day at work, but it's podcast time now, so we're going to have a little bit of a pep talk to get everybody up. We've got heaps coming up in this episode. BJ Watling's retirement, New Zealand contracts, schedules galore, and then we move on to talk about an England-New Zealand test preview. We can't leave it without talking about Cameron Bancroft's comments and Sandpapergate being reopened again. It's all going to be on at the Ashes later in the year. The Barmy Army will not be silenced about this. All coming up on the Top Order Podcast. Stay tuned. Start with home news. BJ Watling announcing his retirement and drops off the contract list for obvious reasons because he's announced that retirement prior to the tour of England. But going out on his swan song, hopefully, with the World Test Championship final and three games for him to play in the mother country.
Yeah, absolutely. Wouldn't that be a great way for his career to end? I mean, I think he touches, if there's a Venn diagram of all the things that we like to talk about here, obviously we've got the Black Caps, we've got wicket keepers, we've got gritty, nuggety players, Aussie battlers, and I mean that in the nicest way about Watling, because that's the kind of player that he is and has been his whole career. He's the kind of guy who seems to only score runs whenever anybody's in trouble. I found some stats when nobody has scored more runs since his debut at six, coming in at six or lower. Since the start of 2018, no one has faced more balls per dismissal at four, coming in at four for 100 or four for 150. And that's the kind of player he is. When they're 300 for four, he gets a duck. He's going to be sorely, sorely missed for New Zealand.
Yeah, two things will forever stand out for me about BJ Watling. If he hasn't made runs, it's because the situation's not dire enough. Mm. And he will finish, if he keeps wicket for these last three tests, he'll be New Zealand's longest serving wicketkeeper in terms of test innings or tests kept. So a tremendous legacy for BJ Watling, and big gloves to fill for whoever comes after him, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I think about BJ Watling, for some reason in my head, I still think about him as that opening batsman that started his career for New Zealand. But then when you actually look at the stats, he played 65 of his 73 tests as a wicketkeeper, which really surprised me when I first saw it.
Well, I guess that's the point I was going to make, is that we tend to forget that he had to work a lot on his keeping in order to make that side and hold his position in the New Zealand team. I think that he revolutionized, not the right word, but he has carried on that sort of nuggety sort of persona that you're talking about, and he's done it really well, better than anyone in New Zealand. We've gone from people, you think about Brendan McCullum as a wicketkeeper, he's the complete opposite in terms of a wicketkeeping batsman. I also think that he you know, probably didn't want to announce it before the game started, but the contract sort of life cycle sort of dictated it. But, yeah, I think he's had a really good career and he should be proud of it.
Yeah, well, when you look at how his, you know, when you run through all those stats of his career, I think he's now the ninth, he's got the ninth most test dismissals of all time. You know, he's scored, I think, more runs than McCullum as a keeper and things. You know, I think you might argue that McCullum had more of an impact maybe when he was in his in the side, but you could easily argue that McCullum is our greatest wicketkeeper of all time.
Watling.
Yeah, Watling, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, for me, I think that the thing that stands out, I think he's a bit better than Nuggety. I think that that's a word that we often use to describe someone. Like, I'd describe Michael Atherton as Nuggety, and you look at his career record, probably doesn't sort of warrant the amount that English fans, particularly of my generation, will talk about him. But Watling, for me, reminds me a lot of Matt Prior, actually. Came into the side as a batter who kept... really had to prove himself with the gloves and turn himself into a really, really good test match keeper. You don't often talk about his keeping now, which is, you know, the old cliche. If you don't notice a wicket keeper, it's because he's doing a good job. The other thing I'd say is his test record is as good as his first test record with the bat. And that, you know, that probably does back up the point that he's Nuggety, right? That, you know, he scores those kind of runs, you know, in the top echelon of the game. But yeah, it's going to be really strange not seeing him with the gloves on. And look, as an English fan, I'm going to be glad not to see him coming in at seven, because he's played some innings against us. That 200, I think, in the Mount couple of years ago, you know, still gives me nightmares on those turgid wickets that I think we talked about.
We have mentioned those turgid wickets before. And I mean, I guess in a way, I guess the positive out of it, we're going to see Tom Blundell now move to his position as wicketkeeper, batting down the order. Raj and I were talking in the car about how now this, on the way up here, now this is going to give Tom Blundell his opportunity. And you know, he's probably going to miss out on this test squad, or on this test side, actually the lineup for the next three tests that they play. But now he'll get his opportunity to shine, and we'll get to see, you know, what Tom Blundell can be as a test cricketer.
When's the next time you do play test cricket after this? Will it be the New Zealand summer?
We're scheduled to play some tests against India, I believe, but they're kind of not on. They're ones that are in the calendar, but not on the calendar, if you know what I mean. They're upcoming tours, but there's actually nothing, no dates announced. And obviously, there's so much going on.
There's a lot of T20 cricket that's scheduled for everybody. Just on the other contract news before we round it out. So the big sort of surprises there. Ajaz dropped out. Who else is there?
There was only Ajaz Patel.
Phillips and Mitchell in, Ajaz and Watling out, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I think the Ajaz one's quite an interesting one. I mean, he's a... it's really he's had a really unlucky summer, and I think the fact that he didn't play, and also the fact that we'll probably get into a lot later around how New Zealand is able to use spin with their current lineup, with someone like Jameson coming into the mould, how we actually balance our side and how New Zealand can fit a spinner into that side probably reflects how Ajaz can actually play, because I think when they do the rankings for New Zealand and how they do the contracts, they go and rank on how much people they expect people to play, and I would say when they line it all up, they probably can't find that many spots for Ajaz to actually play, given that he's only a one format player.
And that's the thing, is you look at the names on the list and who do you actually leave out from that list? They all deserve to be there. New Zealand, from what I've been seeing, I've been looking at a lot of the countries' contracts and how they're doing it centrally. New Zealand's probably has one of the smaller sets of contracts that they give out. I mean, Sri Lanka had 32 prior to the ones they've just given out recently, which is down to 24. Mm. But yeah, it's who do you leave out?
Yeah, well, exactly. And I think on the positive side, it's really great. I mean, we've talked about Daryl Mitchell a lot this summer, but it's great that he's been rewarded with a contract, because he absolutely deserves one. And you know, we'll get to it when we talk about the series. But, you know, he's putting his hand up for a starting spot in all formats now, and he's done a great job.
So what does this mean for the specialist spinner in New Zealand test side going forward?
We've had this conversation before, haven't we?
Well, we've alluded to it, but now it's been formalised. What does that mean?
I think it means what it's meant the whole time, that they're a bit part player in New Zealand test lineup. And, you know, like I said, it's going to be really hard to... The fact that you've got four seamers pushing so hard for spots, and the depth in New Zealand's seam stocks are so strong, I don't know where you can fit a spinner in unless they can bat at the moment, because they're just not that relevant when they play at home. Mm. And then overseas, we just don't have that many overseas tours where they become relevant.
Yeah, I think Rachin Ravindra becomes really important for New Zealand cricket moving forward. If he can continue to develop as a batter, I mean, he's only young, he's only 21, but he shows a bit of promise with the ball and he shows that he can bat at a domestic level. This season, you know, he had a poor season, probably by his standards, at first-class level. But I think that's where the future lies for it. If you want to be a spinner in a New Zealand setup in the next 5 years, you better be able to bat in the top five or six and then bowl some part-time spinner.
I guess the choice for him, though, is if he's got the time to spend on the bowl. And we've seen a lot of guys.
Yeah, that's right.
Steve Smith, you know, came in almost the reverse, didn't he, as a spinner who batted a bit and now, you know, won't bowl for Australia probably ever again.
No, probably not.
You've got guys that are, you know, have come through pretty much every country that have got that little bit of promise. Nasser Hussain and Michael Atherton were actually... open the bowling for England schools as leg spinners, believe it or not, and then barely bowled in their, you know, in their test career. So he's got a choice to make, hasn't he?
Yeah, Ravindra? He does. But you know, guys that can bowl a little bit of spin, particularly if you can bowl left arm spin or wrist spin, add a lot of value. You have a look at Manus in the BBL. He added a lot of value with his leg spin and appealing.
Well, he's got 200 wickets. He's got 200 wickets, test wickets to get, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's got 198 to go, something like that.
Bordy, so don't watch the county championship highlights of Manus bowling. He has sent down some serious pies in the first few rounds.
He hasn't had a great county championship. We'll move on.
So let's talk schedules. Australian home summer. So pretty lean in terms of a warm-up for the Aussie guys leading into the Ashes. Bordy, I know you're going to want to talk probably about the grounds and the orders that have been changed for first time in as long as I can remember.
Yeah, the interesting thing is we don't get a warm-up test, but we get a test in Hobart for the first time since, I think, 2016. It's been a while since we've played a test in Hobart, but Australia will play Afghanistan to open their summer at Blundstone Arena in Hobart, and I think that's effectively going to be either a warm-up for most of the players who are looking to come back into that test side. So guys like Warner and Pukowski will look to get back into test form in that fixture, you would think. There are a few guys who are going to be auditioning for their Ashes squad, a couple of the fast bowlers. I think there'll be a shootout between Nisa and Meredith, potentially even Mitchell Stark in that test against Afghanistan. And Travis Head as well is probably auditioning for his role in the side. So there'll be a few guys who need a tune-up and a couple of guys who will be treating it as an audition.
What do you think about going from Hobart, which is pretty cold,
to
Brisbane, which is pretty warm?
It's reasonably warm. Look, I don't think it will affect them too much. I think there are a few of the guys will get a rest. I think Cummins, Hazelwood will probably get a rest in that test match against Afghanistan, and they'll audition some guys for the Ashes and keep Cummins and Hazelwood, maybe even Lyon fresh for that test match. But it's really one for the batters to try and get some form in before we hit England at the beginning of... or end of November, I think, beginning of December, in Brisbane.
So I guess they're playing six test matches in 8 weeks. There's a couple of ways to go about that first match. So it's actually their first game in like 300 days or something like that.
It's a while.
So if you are Australia, what do you think? I'm going to come to you, Lippy. Do you play your full team? I guess I'm more talking about the bowlers here. Do you play your number one squad going into the Ashes? You're like, you want to prime them ready to go. Or do you rest them a little bit and set them up for that first game in Brisbane?
It was interesting to hear you say that you think they'll rest them, Bordy, because, I mean, I guess it depends. The way to answer this is probably depends on how far deep they go in the World T20, because that'll be obviously just before that. It finishes about mid-November, I think. So if they go right the way through to that, then they have to come back to Australia. We don't know what the quarantine requirements and all of that kind of stuff will be on the way back. So if they're deep in that tournament, then maybe they don't want to get off a plane and go straight into that tournament. But for someone like Lyon, I mean, surely he'd be itching to play test cricket by then, won't he?
Oh, he will, but I would like to see Mitch Swepson play. I would like to see him get a test match this summer because I think he had a good Shield season and he deserves a go. He probably shouldn't play against England unless there's an injury, and that would be the only opportunity for him to get a go. Lyon will probably end up playing a few Shield games. I'm not sure what the Shield schedule is like leading into that test match, but I imagine Lyon will play that. I just want to see Mitch Swepson get a go because I think he's going to be a good player.
My understanding is I do get a bit of Shield cricket in as a warm-up. And yeah. Let's not forget, we've got to fit at least two, if not three, IPLs in before the Ashes start.
Yeah, so there's a lot to get through, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so those guys like Cummins and Hazelwood will have a pretty high workload anyway. So I wouldn't be surprised if one of those two gets a rest. I would think that Cummins and Hazelwood would play four out of the five tests against England. And that leaves room for Pattinson to play two or three test matches in the summer. I would imagine that Stark will play three, maybe four tests. And then you've got an opportunity there to play Meredith or Nisa for a couple of tests because you've got to get through 18 tests worth of bowling from those five or six fast bowlers unless, you know, someone comes out of the woodwork.
A bit off track here, but you said you want to see Swepson get a go. Like, should that be test cricket? Shouldn't you just be playing your best 11 at all times?
Well, we know that that's not a reality, right? We know that particularly for fast bowlers, that playing every test match in a calendar window is no longer a reality. So we know that there's going to have to be some management of fast bowlers. It's like the All Blacks. The All Blacks take an opportunity when they're playing a lesser nation to blood one or two players that they think have a future in the All Blacks, and that's what I'd like to see Australia do with Swepson.
And you've seen that rhetoric come out of the England camp as well. They've been really, really pointed to say that the likes of James Bracey, Ollie Robinson, and a couple of others, they've said, we don't want people debuting in the Ashes.
Yep.
So this summer, for them, is going to be about blooding some players as well. So maybe we're going to see that as a reality.
I think it is. It's great that Afghanistan test is going to be really exciting. It's great that they're going to be down there. They look through their tests. They've had six tests. They've had three wins, three losses, no draws yet.
Mm.
They've knocked off Bangladesh. You know, there wouldn't be. I don't think any test playing nations would have had the success they've had through six games. I know that, you know, their other wins are against Ireland and Zimbabwe, but even still, you know, many, many countries took a long, long time to win their first test. So I think that the fact that they've gone so quickly into a test win and three test wins is really impressive.
Oh, massively impressive. And even though I've said that there'll be guys who will be rested, it's not because we're taking them lightly at all. It's because we need to get guys ready for the next series. And that's no disrespect to Afghanistan at all. If it was Pakistan, if it was Sri Lanka, if it was anyone other than maybe one of the two or three big sides in world cricket, I think that's what they'd be doing. Just before we move off the Australian test schedule, the women are going to play two tests this summer, which is fantastic news. So there's a test that's scheduled against India, that's TBC, and as part of Australia and New Zealand competing in the Women's Ashes, which is a multi-format championship, Australia will play a test in the capital over the Australia Day weekend against England, which will be fantastic for people who want to get down to the Manuka Oval and see it. And Australia have done a really good job, I think, of making sure that there are very few clashes between men's and women's cricket over the summer. So you should be able to get along to see as much of that international cricket in Australia as possible. It's good to see.
And Bordy, a break from tradition. We've got the first test in Brisbane, which we normally see, but the last test moving to the Optus in Perth, which you're not happy about?
Only because I think traditionally England struggle a little bit in Perth. I know it's not as bouncy and as fearsome as the WACA has been in days gone past, and I think England have got a pretty good pace attack that could do some damage at the WACA. But I feel like psychologically Australia have had an advantage in Brisbane and Perth up until maybe last summer that we have not, business speak, leveraged in the last couple of test series. So it looks like we'll play what could be a dead rubber in Perth. If it's the last test, it's going to be an absolute ball tearer. But I don't think we've scheduled it in the optimum way that gives Australia
an
best.
An absolute what, sorry?
Ball tearer.
Is that a technical term?
It is. It's a very technical term.
Business speak, was it?
I dropped into business speak and then I had to get as far out of business speak as I possibly could. So, look, it's going to be an awesome series. I just hope that it's still alive in Perth.
Well, we're going to split this week in cricket into two. So we'll be back after the break to talk IPL in the UAE, potentially Cameron Bancroft, county cricket and bamboo bats. But a challenge to listeners before we do go to a break. If you can get ball terror into a meeting, please do write in and tell us how you managed to shoehorn that into your Monday morning stand-up. We'll be back after the swish. Welcome back. We're going to talk scheduling squared. Let's start in the West Indies. Baldy? Raj?
Yeah, I'll come off the long run. So it's good to see that the West Indies have announced their schedule for this summer. So there's three tours going ahead. So South Africa, They've got two tests and five 2020s. That's in June and the start of July. They've got a white ball test, white ball series against Australia. That's the one that Marnus is not going to be able to make it over for the county thing. I don't know if you've seen the waves around that, but that will be good. That's 2020s and ODIs. And then finally, Pakistan's going and playing five 2020s and two tests there as well. So a total of 15 2020 matches for the West Indies at home. And it's good to see other nations touring there after the West Indies have done a lot for cricket awesome. Over the last year.
Do you want to talk IPL scheduling? So lots going on there. There's a talk of a disrupted English summer so they can squeeze that window in. Don't think the counties are particularly happy about that, with the 100 likely to be affected if that was the play. What do we want to say about the IPL? Is it reasonable to actually squeeze this in with the amount of international cricket and the amount of bubbles that we've got going on?
That's the point I want to make. I actually think it's ridiculous. I completely ridiculous that they, I know that there's a lot of money involved, but do the players aren't going to want to go to this, are they? I just cannot see any of the players wanting to go to this, particularly any of the international players, who the Indian ones who are going to be coming straight off this five-match test tour again in England. Then you've got, I think they've got 4 weeks, a four-week window from like the 15th of September to the 15th of October where they can try and squeeze it in. But the 18th of October, I think the T20 World Cup's supposed to start. So I just cannot see why any player that actually has ambitions to play in that T20 World Cup and wants to win would want to go to this IPL where you're going to be crammed, you're going to be playing all these games as quickly as possible in the UAE. I know that then the T20 World Cup will probably be there as well. Mm. Can anyone give me a reason why you'd want to go other than money? Because I know it all does come down to money.
I've got two reasons. Money. First one. And secondly,
yeah, but I was going to say that.
Secondly, what better way to warm up for the World Cup than play in those conditions that you're going to play in? I think I haven't read, I'm not fully up to date on it, but I think they want to play the whole tournament in 3 weeks, did they say?
Yeah, the remainder of the tournament? 30 days.
Right. Yeah. So it's a hard one because we're here talking about what people should be doing or whatever, but the real decision should be in the players' hands. You know? If they tee this up and go, this is what we want to do, make your decision. And people will make the decision with their feet.
Do you think it would be a viable tournament if none of the international capped cricketers went? Like if they all said, well, we've got to prepare for the T20 World Cup that's in a week after. We can't physically fit ourselves into the bubble. Is the IPL still viable as a domestic-only Indian tournament with those eight teams? I think it is. I actually think with just the uncapped non-international players, it would still be a pretty good tournament. It wouldn't be like at the heights that the Indian Premier League gets to when it's, you know, at its very peak. But those, some of those domestic players, I think, would still give a good account of themselves in a big watchable cricket.
I actually think no. And the other reason I think no is because even the international Indian players wouldn't be there. Because they'll still be
I'm factoring that in.
I personally think it's around the product, and I think the product is diminished when those people aren't there. Mm.
I think it's that. Yeah, we've touched upon it, but for me, it's about the welfare of the players. And look, I think some of them would want to go because it's going to get them in nick for that T20 World Cup. But let's be honest, there isn't a cricket board in the world that hasn't bent over backwards to accommodate IPL windows. You know, you look back not that long, Kevin Peterson was chastised for wanting to go and play in that. Every nation has now done what he was saying should have been done 10, 12 years ago and freed up their players to be able to be available for that whole window. When, look, a pandemic, but also, let's be honest, some pretty piss poor planning has led to the curtailment of this tournament. They're now saying, well, hold on, we want to try and carve out even 10 days of a 40-day period to try and squeeze in the rest of a franchise tournament. I'm sorry, it just does not sit well with me when you're talking about the welfare of the players and that ultimately they are the product that you've got, the players, not the franchises.
But what if they want to play?
I just think it's creating a really, really dangerous precedent for world cricket. And look, I'll go back to my point. I think this is, you know, it is completely reasonable to carve out a window so that all of that IP can play in a franchise tournament of the magnitude of the IPL, which I've got to admit, I've come round on massively as a fan, partly since we started doing the Fantasy League that I've done, you know, tremendously well in. But also just because the quality of the product, I think, has improved with every nation actually committing fully to carving out that window. The fact that we were even talking about England and New Zealand players potentially missing a test match at Lord's in order to allow them to play in a franchise tournament final shows how far the thinking has come, that we actually would even find that palatable. And but this is taking the piss, to be honest, I think.
And we're playing the tiny violin for the cricket boards, you know, they're bending over backwards. I understand that we shouldn't be doing that. You know my feelings on that. People shouldn't be playing in the IPL if they have international cricket to play. But at the end of the day, there is a real risk that you lose international quality players to the T20 circuit in this day and age. And that's what the boards have to deal with. And that's why this window is there. And they have to have the option, if they want to play, to go and play it. It's up to the players at the end of the day.
Yeah. And look, the ECB have actually made it pretty clear. They've said, nah, we let you have your contract to go and play in it. And this is now clashing with international cricket. Sorry, you aren't going to be released to go and play in the tournament. And I think it needs Cricket Australia to do the same. And then all of a sudden, you've got the two other biggest boards, actually playing a little part that I think ultimately is also going to help the smaller test playing nations as well. Because if England and Australia don't put their foot down, then all of a sudden we've got even more problems for New Zealand cricket, for Pakistan cricket, for South Africa cricket, et cetera, et cetera.
So what was the summary then in that final?
I think they should play the IPL. They should squeeze it in if they can.
We'll go.
Yeah, if only because, you know, I'm pretty sure I was just about to turn my form round in that fantasy league. I really was. Guys, what do we want to talk about next? Bamboo bats, Baldy? Or balls made of tofu? What do we think?
Well, this has been a recent development. It's come out of England, funnily enough, Cambridge University study, I think, suggesting that a bamboo cricket bat, layered bamboo, kind of
laminated, which is illegal.
Concertina together and stuck together with resin provides a better sweet spot and better sort of for bat on ball.
Because we're lacking that.
Dynamics, yeah, because bat hasn't dominated ball enough. What we want to do is find a bat that's even more stringy and reboundy than a regular cricket bat. It was brought up at the weekend by a member of my family who was quite keen to make sure that I was across this issue, but I'm a bit of a traditionalist, and I don't think
it's a sustainability thing, right? That's what they're talking about.
That's the angle, yeah, is that it's more sustainable
and a cost thing as well. So they think they can produce the bats more economically, which would help the growth of the game. No pun intended. But
yep.
For me, bamboo is a grass; it's not a wood. Let's move on.
Cool, done.
Yeah, I'm happy with
that. Okay, thank you. Right, fine.
And so moving from wood to sand, Baldy.
Here we go again.
Well, mate, I'm sorry, Cameron Bancroft, interviewed by, I think, the Guardian newspaper. He's had a county stint over in England and alluded to the fact that the bowlers were fully aware of the indiscretions of some of the batting units. The fast bowling cartel has come out. Nathan Lyon, I think, chipped in and said, nah, mate, as well, you know, joined up with his brethren and has said, of course, we didn't know what was going on. The gift that keeps on giving, Baldy.
It does. It keeps on giving. And as long as people keep asking questions, people are going to keep answering them. And I think we're going to get very little in the way of more information until such time has passed that statutes of limitations have expired and people are able to write their tell-all post-career biographies. But until we get a ghostwriter involved, I don't think we'll ever get really to an admission from anyone that they were involved in any way. Look, the fast bowlers have come out and said, we didn't know, the condition of the ball didn't change sufficiently that the umpires thought it was altered and the umpires didn't change it. So how would we know if the ball's been altered sufficiently? So that's their line. I have no reason to disbelieve what they've said because they've given me no reason to doubt their bona fides.
So you would disbelieve Cameron Bancroft?
No, so Cameron Bancroft didn't say that the bowlers knew. He said that awareness is self-evident. So you can read into that what you will.
It's a very intelligent comment from Cameron Bancroft.
Yeah, Cameron Bancroft has, I think, spent far too long at the University of Cambridge and not long enough in the Nets, perhaps. But look, his comment is deliberately open-ended, as is David Sakers. Well, you could blame me, you could blame a whole bunch of people for what happened. And I think what he's trying to say is we failed as a coaching unit and as a leadership unit to put our cricketers and our people in a spot where they know what's expected of them. And when you don't give that leadership, bad stuff happens. People start taking things. People start acting in a way that is not in line with the culture that you want to set, right? That's a failure of leadership. And that's why Australian cricket came down so hard on Steve Smith, because he failed as a leader. Not because he Sergeant Schultz'd his way around it and said, I know nothing, but because he didn't set an environment where the players knew that that was bad. I mean, they should have known that that was bad anyway. It's cheating, and it's cheating of an egregious nature. But they didn't establish that leadership. And I think that's what David Saker is really saying, is we all should be blamed for that, or could be blamed for that. Not that whether or not we knew it was going to happen or we had an involvement in it.
Serious question. Cameron Bancroft played his last game in a baggy green cap?
No. No, I don't think so. I don't think that he's done anything to put his name through the record books. He's done his punishment, and he should be seen as having served his time and rehabilitated. He may not ever lead the Australian cricket team, but he certainly shouldn't be. You know, as long as Steve Smith and David Warner can play, then why shouldn't Cameron Bancroft play? Raj?
He has played. He came back in the Ashes.
Yeah, yeah. There's no reason why he shouldn't play again.
He's just, yeah, well, he's got to be good enough. There's two aspects to this, right? So there's the, did they know, right? That's great. Park that on the side. The second thing is, did Cricket Australia actually want to know? Did they carry out a thorough enough investigation, or were they happy to put their head in the sand, which is what a lot of people are saying. The guys like Michael Clark and Adam Gilchrist are saying things along those lines. Did they actually do a thorough enough investigation? Thoughts?
Without being privy to it, I don't know the answer, but it would appear as if these wounds are going to be opened up. And I don't know. Maybe it's a fellow countryman's newspaper's job to stir things up when we've got such an important series on the horizon for both countries.
Absolutely, you should.
But yeah, I think you're going to hear a little bit more about this. And I think we said last week the Barmy Army certainly going to continue to sing about it.
Yeah. I think if Australian cricket wanted to stick their head in the sand, they would have accepted the ICC's punishment, maybe tabled, you know, that again on top of it and said, look, we've punished our players twice as much as anyone else has been punished in the history of cricket for ball tampering. We've given Smith an extra game. We've given Bancroft an extra two games. Then we're done. They didn't do that. They gave players an unprecedented and not unjustified, but completely out of proportion ban compared to any other cricketer who's tampered with a ball in the history of sport, right? It's a ban along the lines of doping or match fixing,
yeah.
Really. It's not a ban for tampering with the condition of the ball. So to suggest that Australian cricket has stuck their head in the sand from that perspective, I don't think is justified. The comments that were made were around, did Australia go to the lengths that they needed to establish whether or not it was a conspiracy or a long running campaign to alter the standard, to alter the condition of the cricket ball over a long period of time? I can't answer that, and I don't think Australia cricket got to the bottom of that. What's interesting, Raj, was your point that you made to me the other day, is that no one has been convicted of ball tampering since that incident, in what we're closing on 3 years now since that happened. And the amount of reverse swing that we have seen in world cricket since that incident has gone down pretty substantially. Now, I don't think that that's necessarily not coincidental, but you know, people who want to connect those dots are going to start connecting those dots.
I guess we have had at least 12 months now with no saliva on the ball as well. So
yeah, different conditions.
Potentially.
Yeah. So there's cause and effect questions that are being asked and stuff like that. But if you want to draw a really long bow on any number of these issues, you can, because you're right. Australia didn't interview all the people that were in the touring party at that time. They interviewed most of them, but not all of them. They didn't interview people multiple times to make sure that they, you know, they got their jobs right. You know, they're not line of duty AC-12.
I was going to say, unless we get Mulder and Scully in, I don't think we're ever going to get to the bottom of that. Bottom of this.
Yeah, so unless you're in...
I do like that party line from Australia, or Cricket Australia. They say, if you have some evidence, bring it to us and we will investigate it. Otherwise, stop talking about it.
Yep.
Fair enough.
Maybe we should too.
Well, that is a nice segue. It's wetter than an otter's pocket in the UK at the moment, but not stopping Darren Stevens from continuing some pretty sensational performances as an evergreen cricketer of 45 years old and definitely rocking the XL shirt as well, Darren Stevens. 190 in his last game for Kent, sharing in a 166-run partnership with Miguel Cummins, who put in a very stellar one run.
Oh, is that what that is in the notes? He made one.
Yeah,
that's the best bit about this whole thing, that's particularly for me as someone at tail end. I've been involved in not to that extent, but I think I've been involved in a 100-run punch where I scored about 7, and they're fantastic. That's what you want when you're a tail end batter. If you can get someone to 100, it's as good as getting 100 because you're not going to do it yourself when you're down at that level and you don't really get those opportunities. So yeah, absolutely brilliant from Miguel Cummins.
Shamefully enough, I was involved in an opening partnership as an opening batter where we were 100 for none and I was 19 not out. So you know, you don't necessarily just need to be a tail ender, Stuart, to be in that situation. But Darren Stevens, he's a hell of a cricketer.
Is it ridiculous to think that he should probably get an England go soon? Or is it just not? Because he's putting up huge numbers in county cricket, isn't he, for the last couple of years?
If you can see Big C's face right now.
I know, but I what would he have to do? Because the numbers that he's putting up are quite staggering over the last few years.
If you looked at them on paper and you didn't know how old Darren Stevens was, you would have to consider him for England selection, right? If you did a double blind study and you put everybody's stats in a big giant bag and you had to kind of pick them out and look at them all without names attached to them or ages and then pick an England side, he'd be the first person picked, wouldn't he?
Look, if Billy Beane and Brad Pitt were picking this side, look, absolutely. I think I've seen actually probably more county cricket this year than I have in a long, long time because the streams have been really, really good.
Yeah, they have been.
For obvious reasons, you know, fans not allowed in the ground, so that the counties have really pushed those live streams. But it is nibbling around a hell of a lot. The amount of really, really good players, and Marnus Labuschagne is one of them. He has been pinned LBW 3 or 4 times where literally he's just getting in line and it's just jagging all over the place and you're getting hit shin high on these low little seaming wickets by 75-mile-an-hour seamers. With all due respect to Darren Stevens, I think you put his 72-mile-an-hour medium pace with the keeper up onto a wicket at Lords that doesn't do a lot sideways,
or Brisbane or Perth,
he's gonna rack up enough air points to get home seriously upgraded. And look, notwithstanding that, look, his batting was brutal, but again, made some real hay. The ball's not really bouncing too much.
Yeah, I did see, as much as I wanted to play devil's advocate there, I did see the highlights and all the boundaries that he hit. And you gave Marnus's bowling a bit of a slag off before. The bowling didn't look that flash. I can't remember who we was playing, and obviously no. Well, this is disrespect to those bowlers. I was going to say no disrespect, but
you are a little bit. Yeah.
It wasn't very good. Let's just say that.
Awesome. Well, look, that just about wraps up this week in cricket. We will be back to talk an England-New Zealand series test preview. So stay tuned and we'll be back after the swish. So first test coming up at Lords on June the 2nd. New Zealand about to start a 3-day intra-squad game, if they can get on with the weather. All the social media pictures so far have seen New Zealand in the indoor schools at Southampton. What are we thinking about the lineup for that first test, which, you know, is a warm-up after all for the World Test Championship as well?
Yeah, well, I guess that's probably the place to start, I think, is so New Zealand's got these two tests against England and then they've got the World Test Championship. Those three tests from start to finish, I think, are concluded within 21 days or something. It's a very short turnaround between all of that time. And I suppose the question for me really is what do New Zealand do? Because you can look at these tests, you know, Baldy, you mentioned before, these are great opportunities to kind of, sometimes these kind of tests are great opportunities to introduce players into your squad. New Zealand have brought 20 people over there. They've got people like Will Young, who hasn't had a great opportunity. He's been over there in England. He scored a couple of hundreds for Durham. You've got someone like Ratchan Ravindra, Jacob Duffy, people who haven't had the opportunity at that level. Mm. But then you're also working towards the World Test Championship final, which is in 3 weeks, and you want to have your players primed for that position. So, I mean, where do we stand on this? We've got Trent Bolt, who's going to miss the first test anyway. Mm. But in that first test, Raja, are you picking your best 11 for New Zealand?
I don't think that New Zealand has the luxury of doing the whole Western rotation thing. Just over the years, we haven't had that sort of success. We've got a team now that can go anywhere in the world and be successful. I think it's time for us to cash in on that a little bit. Obviously, there will be times where we need to rest and rotate people. But I think we've had a massive break from all cricket. It's time to go and play our best team.
So in that first test, Jamieson, Wagner and Southee in your bowling attack picked themselves. You're probably going to take an all-rounder at seven and another bowler, you would think, into that test against England and Watling bats at six. Like, that's New Zealand's formula. Who have you guys got at seven and eight in that squad if Jamieson, Wagner and Southee all pick themselves?
The all-rounder spot is the really, really interesting question for me, because it depends on a couple of things. One, it depends on, do we want to play a spinner at all? Because if you do, I think the only realistic way to get one, probably in this, when New Zealand is at full strength, Bolt will be in that extra bowler spot that you mentioned.
Yeah.
So you could go, okay, well, while Bolt's not here, we could play Ajaz as that fourth bowler, and we could pick either Daryl Mitchell or Colin de Gronholm as that seven spot all-rounder.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way to get your spinner in. The other way is you go, I'm going to pick out four seamers, and you have Mitchell Santner, who, as we've discussed many times, he's not a particularly wicket-taking option. He's a holding bowler. He bowls much in the same way that he bowls in the limited overs formats. He bowls that way. You know, he can do a job for you, and he can be a batsman at seven as well.
And has done for New Zealand against England.
Yep. And, you know, yeah. That summer when England was down here, he took three wickets, and they proved to be really important. He can do that job. But, you know, I don't like that, because I don't feel like it's a very attacking option. I would love to see, personally, Daryl Mitchell rewarded, because I think he's just been so good this summer, and I think he deserves to kind of be the incumbent at seven. My only question really around him is, can he do a good enough job with the ball? Because we didn't really see him get that opportunity in the New Zealand summer, because he didn't need to.
So I guess for me, if I'm answering that question, seven and eight, I'm picking Matt Henry as my bowler, who's going to play. And for that seventh spot, I am probably picking my best batsman. And I think that is Daryl Mitchell. I think that if you want to play Santner, you can, because he has that variety in his bowling. But I think I want to elongate that batting lineup if I have to, and I'm going to trust my bowlers to do the job.
I guess the other thing is Is there any thought, I suppose, I know they won't do it, but I know we have talked in the past about trying to pick a specialist batsman at six and going, you know, maybe Will Young or playing Young up the order and playing Conway down below and going, okay, well, let's just have six specialist batsmen, Watling, and then our four seamers. I don't think they will do that, but it is always an option that they could try and put in place if they are really worried about the seaming tracks in England.
So I'm just really surprised that we've not mentioned Colin de Gronholm here from a form over the last couple of years. You know, I don't know the stats, but I'd imagine he's averaging pretty close to 50 over the last couple of years with the bat, to your point around playing your best batsman at seven. Can bowl a few overs and has the best mullet, I think, you have ever...
If we were just picking hairdos.
If you're picking hairdos. But all seriousness, though, does he not deserve to be in that spot, given that he's helped get New Zealand to this World Test Championship over the course of the last 2 years?
I thought about Colin de Gronholm a lot in preparation for this podcast, and I really wanted to put him in that number seven spot. I think he has the kind of bowling that suits English conditions a little bit better than Daryl Mitchell, in that he has a track record of nibbling the ball around in conditions that are friendly. The reason I didn't have him in there, or I had him bracketed with Mitchell, and why I wanted to ask you guys from a New Zealand point of view, is I think you're right. I think Mitchell has had such a good season that he kind of deserves to keep his spot. And I know that Colin de Gronholm has been battling with injury, and that kind of counts against him a little bit because it has allowed Mitchell to rise up over the course of the summer across all formats. But I do think that Mitchell does provide you a little bit more with the bat, but his bowling is a little bit of an unknown. And if Colin de Gronholm was fit, I think he would intrigue the selectors because he has that ability to just wobble the ball about a bit.
Well, I completely agree with you there. And I would play De Gronholm if I wanted to play a spinner. If I wanted to play Ajaz, I would play De Gronholm because De Gronholm can be your fourth seamer.
Yeah.
And this first test is the opportunity to do that. But to me, if you're looking at De Gronholm and you're picking him as a, you know, because of the things that he can do with the ball, and you've already got four seamers in there, like those, if those four seamers can't do the job, I think we're struggling. You know, like
yeah. I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. My balance would, I had Santner down at eight, and then a question of De Gronholm and Mitchell, because I would want a spinner in there, I think.
I don't know why we're discussing Ajaz. We've just talked about how he's lost his contract. He's being, I'm going to use the word irrelevant, that's probably very harsh, but at the moment he is irrelevant to that New Zealand setup, definitely in New Zealand.
In New Zealand, but I think if they play a spinner, they would like to play Ajaz as their spinner. It's just that how it's the balance and how they do that because of the emergence of Kyle Jamieson. Really,
it's the most animated I've ever seen you.
If they do that, podcast. If they do that in England, then they're definitely going to play him in the subcontinent. They're definitely going to play him everywhere. So where is he not going to be played?
Well, he's not going to be played in New Zealand, and that's the thing. That's why he doesn't get a contract, because most of our games in New Zealand, he's just not going to get that opportunity. So yeah, I think that they won't play him in these three tests. But I think that they still view him as our number one test spinner.
Breathe, Lippy.
When it comes back to Colin De Gronholm, I think that's a really good point. I think there is a stat there that over a rolling 2-year average, at some point he was averaging 50 in test cricket, scoring runs. But possession, if we're in America, is 9/10 of the law.
So, I'm pretty sure that's one of those urban misadventures.
Anyway.
It sounds good.
He doesn't have position currently. He's been out of the side. There's people who have come in and really, really performed who I think deserve their first shot. Anyway, but good question, Baldy.
And let's say we've picked those guys in that first test. We picked our best lineup. You just play them again? You play them all three tests, same squad?
If you're winning, you know, I don't feel like you change a winning squad unless there's other factors like the pitches.
Yep.
Like they're in Chennai or something.
Yeah, we're not worried about the workload. Three tests and such quick turnaround?
No.
Not from Wagner, not from Jamieson, not from Southee. Bolt's only going to play a couple of tests. I think you're fine.
4 years ago, we wouldn't be worried about a three-test workload, would we?
No. Good. I like it.
So Bolt essentially is coming in for the seamer who doesn't perform in those first two tests, World Test Championship final?
I think those. Jamieson, Wagner, Southee are all in, aren't they? I mean, the thing is that those guys have just done it for... They've done it, in Jameson's case, it's only been 1 year, but Wagner and Southee have been doing it for years and years and years. And you know, your point around putting guys who've put New Zealand in this position, I think, even when we talked to Matt Henry about how these guys want to be, they've worked towards this, and it is the opportunity to do, they view it as the opportunity to do something special. These are the guys that have earned that right.
They've earned that right to be there, yeah.
Okay, so let's move on. Let's talk about the real rock stars of cricket here. Let's talk about the batsmen. So... If the New Zealand in the New Zealand lineup, so Latham's going to hold that one spot, opening the batting. You've got a blank spot there. You've got your Williamson, Taylor, and Nichols. I'm going to give him number
five. Is Taylor fit?
Taylor is currently
he's going to be fit.
He is in England. He's okay. Gone away with the squad.
Okay.
So you've got two spots. You've got an opening spot, and
you've got an opening spot. If Taylor's fit, you've only got one spot,
and you've got Will Young, who's scoring runs in England currently, and you've got Devin Conway.
Who's right up there with New Zealand's greats alongside Williamson and Taylor.
What do you do, Baldy?
He's got to open the batting. That's the spot available. I pick Devin Conway.
Oh, that's not even a question, honestly.
The question is, do you open with Devin Conway?
I think you do.
He's batted three for Wellington. He's opened in other formats of the game. Yes. I think Binksy made a good point when we were talking about Conway in earlier episodes that, you know, Test cricket is a different beast and you know, playing against Stuart Broad, Jimmy Anderson, this is going to be a massive test and it's a much bigger test than the white ball stuff that we've seen him in. But he's just looked so good at a international level. He's looked so good in New Zealand first class level for such a long time. I know Will Young has done a decent job. He's been scoring runs in county cricket. But it's the same case that, you know, we've made about him. Conway sort of, before Young was really in the conversation around whether Blundell should be opening or Conway just looks better than those guys, and I think he's just got to be there.
It's no disrespect to Will Young at all that you're picking Devin Conway ahead of him in that test lineup. It would be like saying, you've only got one spot in the World 11, who are you going to put in from New Zealand, Kane or Ross? You know, if you selected Ross, then you're not going to lose anything.
Then you've made the wrong call. But
yeah, but you have to pick Kane, right? You have to pick Kane because he is a better cricketer. That's not because Ross Taylor is not a good cricketer, and it's not because Will Young is not a good batsman who would do the job. It's because, at the moment, Devin Conway is a shade or two better.
The only other option I can see is that you move Henry Nicholls up to open, which I feel is supremely unfair on him.
Mm.
But
it's
also,
just another stopgap, right?
It's one of those ones where you pick your best batsman and you fit him in.
Yeah.
Fit him in the team.
Spot on.
Yeah. I feel Young will be and feel a little bit hard done by. But, you know, he's averaging just under 40 in this county season. Conway's probably the right ahead of those numbers, I would think, in that test. Side, I guess what might put the cat among the pigeons is if Ross Taylor isn't fit for that first test, and then they probably go Latham, Conway.
I think Young would open,
and Conway might bat four.
Well, yeah.
That would solve a few problems, but
yeah,
we want Ross Taylor there if he's fit.
We do.
Oh, absolutely.
And moving on to England, Binksy, I mean, we talked about this New Zealand side. It's quite a settled lineup. You know, we're trying to manufacture, you know, things, situations so that some of these new guys can get in. England have decided not to play the IPL players. There are a few new names we talked about on the podcast. I think after that England-India series, we named all of those fringe players, that batting lineup for England. And, you know, you run through the likes of Sibley, Crawley, Lawrence, Pope, Burns, all those guys, and we went, you know, who do you keep, who do you discard, and they've decided to keep all of them in this squad. Where, you know, what do you see England doing in this series, I suppose?
Yeah, so the interesting thing for me is Rory Burns has scored some runs in this recent round of county championship matches, which has made Raj extremely happy. But I think you have a 50 and 100 for Surrey in a draw against Middlesex. So, I think he's probably just done enough at the right time to make sure that he's got that opening spot. Sibley come back for Warwickshire, 40-odd in their game. But apparently there's still some concerns over whether or not he can field. So, you know, you can hide someone in a county championship match a little bit. Not sure you're going to be able to do that in a test match, but you would assume that if he's fit enough to play this round of county championship games and comes through that unscathed and can do a bit of catching practice, he takes his place at the top of the order. Crawley at 3, Root at 4. Lawrence probably keeps his spot at 5, Ollie Pope at 6, and then Ben Folkes at 7. As you mentioned, IPL players missing, so there'll be no Chris Wokes, there'll be no Jofra Archer, there'll be no Benjamin Stokes, there'll be no Joss Butler. It's looking like...
No Johnny Bairstow.
He's not in the squad either, so he might find it very difficult to make his way in.
Johnny Bairstow.
Yeah. So I think for me that the choice is really if they go really, really, really left field and also are extremely harsh, James Bracey could get a go with the gloves at 7 ahead of Ben Folkes. If they want to fiddle around with trying to fit an extra bowler in there. I don't think that they do that. In my personal opinion, I think England have been pretty consistent with their selections. I don't think they're about to throw folks out with the bathwater.
Is that from a batting? So you're saying that Bracey's a better batsman than folks?
Yeah. So Bracey bats top 4 for his county side, right, Gloucestershire, and he's got the gloves for Gloucestershire as well. So there's an argument he might actually bat a little bit higher up the order. And look, I guess it's one of those conversations, you know, if he really wants to have a run, does he sit behind Joss Butler, who's, you know, likely to play another 2 or 3 years of Test cricket at least before the IPL coin is just too irresistible for him to throw it all in? Or does he potentially go back to his county side and say, well, actually, no, I want to bat up the order because I can see an opportunity. And there, for me, it's a shootout between Robinson and Overton for that extra seaming spot. And I think you would have to, you would need to don full riot gear if you were going to go into either James Anderson or Stuart Broad's room and tell them that they aren't opening the bowling in the first test match of the summer. So I think they They are locks. And then a little bit like New Zealand, there's a question as to whether or not England play a spinner. Leach would be the man that you would play. I don't think Don Bess is going to play in England, no matter how much he offers with the bat and with his fielding. So I think it's a shootout for Leach to play. So that, you know, there is a chance they play an all-seam attack. I find it highly unlikely they will. I think Leach will play with Broad, Anderson, Robinson or Overson and Leach, and they'll go in with that four-man attack. Maybe a few filthy little spinners from Joe Root, who's been bowling the county championship as well.
So we have mentioned it earlier in the podcast. There is the statement or the line there that no English player should debut in the Ashes this year. So what is your feelings on that sort of statement? And I guess, is that too forward thinking? They're not thinking about the now.
Well, let's remember that these two test matches against New Zealand are not in the World Test Championship. So they don't really count for a hell of a lot from a future tours perspective. Or there's nothing on these games other than that pre-Ashes and pre-India preparation, actually, for the rest of the summer. That's a really big series.
Pride?
Coming up. Pride, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, pride comes before a fall, doesn't it? but look, jokes aside, I honestly think that England's biggest worry for me is at the top of the order in terms of their batting. Stokes walks back into this side. This is a shootout for the likes of Burns and Lawrence and Pope to see who is going to be going to the Ashes. I can't see a debutant from a batting perspective from outside of this group playing the Ashes in November, December this year.
I mean, the fact that we were talking, you know, a couple of months ago, or a month ago, whatever it was, about, you know, are any of these guys going to kind of survive the chop, I think is the point here, that and a good one that you've just raised there. It's a great opportunity for these guys, isn't it? And it may be last chance for some of these guys. I know they're young, but, you know, once you talked about position being 9/10 of the law, that's the thing for these guys. If they lose their spot, then you're giving someone else an opportunity to get in. And, yeah, will they ever get it back? Because
the challenge for these guys is that there's going to be one or two less spots available in that batting lineup, you know, once you get into that India series and Butler and Stokes come back. And if anyone else emerges out of the woodwork, there could be two less spots in the order. So I think for Lawrence and for Crawley and for Burns and Sibley, maybe, I think those four guys are really in a shootout. I think the England selectors will stick with Ollie Pope a little bit. I think that he's got a little bit more rope than the other guys.
I think that they will. I still stand by my comments from a few weeks ago. I think these guys, you know, as much as I like the look of Pope, I actually really, really like the look of Crawley.
I think he's going to be a
fantastic cricketer. I like the confidence that Dan Lawrence has brought in. You know, he's had some ripping up trees seasons in county cricket. But, you know, he hasn't really fully shown, apart from that 70-odd in India, the kind of mettle that I would want to see. I think we get our arses handed to us by India and still go to the Ashes, because that, if you look at that top four, there's, or top five, there's really only for me Crawley, Root and Ben Stokes that I think are bankers for a 400 run series in Australia. And we know that you need to score 450 in Australia to be competitive, so I honestly just can't see where those runs are going to come from. I think this might be a bit of an arse nipper in terms of the seam attacks, England and New Zealand. And I think comment down there is two bowling attacks that are, you know, if not at the peak of their powers, pretty close to that. So, you know, I don't expect this to be an absolute run fest. And yeah, like the Ashes, you know, the England guys and the Australian guys, there weren't many hundreds in that Ashes series, and certainly weren't too many batting sides or batting players averaging over 40 in that series. And I think we'll see the same here.
We always finish, we obviously have shown in the past few weeks how good our predictions are. We always do like to finish with predictions. This two-test series, let's just start with that. Raj?
What's the weather like?
Poor.
At the moment, it's wet.
Very wet.
Okay, I'm going to go 1-0 to New Zealand.
1-0.
Two.
Damn it. I was hoping that you'd move on quickly. Yeah, I think New Zealand do win 1-0. I don't know why. I just think New Zealand's bowling attack has got a slight edge, even though you've got Anderson and Broad in that England side.
I'll go, because I think New Zealand wins these two tests. I really think if we play them, obviously, I think we've been playing some really great cricket in the last year or so. You know, Australia tourist aside, these conditions should suit our bowling attack. I think we go out there and win. That England batting lineup, to me, without, you know, England is missing some of their best players. New Zealand is taking, apart from Bolt in that first test, we're taking a full strength side over there, trying to build towards something that actually really matters to those guys. I think they'll be looking to win that 2-0.
If there's no weather, New Zealand win this 2-0. But the long range forecast for me, it's 0-0 because it's going to rain too much. But no, genuinely, I think if we get two games that have enough overs to constitute a decent game of cricket, I see New Zealand winning this 2-0.
If Archer and Stokes are playing, what is your prediction then? Is this based solely on the squad? Because the squad is interpreted to be a little bit weaker than normal.
Yeah, look, but I still think to an extent the bowling is there without Archer. If you had to press me off the top of my head, 1-0 to New Zealand still, even with Archer and Stokes there. I've just really got worries. Root, we're going to rely a hell of a lot on Joe Root.
He's going to have to score 100 in one of the Test matches for England to be a chance, right? Or someone in that other group of four or five guys has got to play out of their skin.
Yeah.
And well, I can't see it happening.
Burns going to score a big 100 in one of these tests, I think.
Well, I hope you're wrong.
I'll have a whiskey bet on that with you. Shake hands.
Burns to score 100?
Yeah.
You said a big 100.
What define a big 100?
101.
Okay, time to wrap up, I think.
140, 140 plus.
Sure, I'll take it.
Okay, excellent. Johnny Walker on the way for one of us, and we'll let you know in a couple of weeks' time. Who has savoured a fine blend of Scotch whiskey.
Well, that just about wraps up this episode of the Top Order Podcast. Make sure you find us on social media or thetoporderpodcast.com. Look out for Ken Rutherford, who'll be out in your feed as well in the coming days. We've got plenty of interviews coming up, so stay tuned for that as we close in on New Zealand, England in the Test matches and the World Test Championship between India and New Zealand coming up very soon. As Adam would say, good night, God bless, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.